Perkins, members of the White House Conference on Children in a Democracy. I come here tonight with a very heavy heart, because shortly ago, I received word of the passing of a very old friend of mine, a very great American, Senator Borah. I had known him for a great many years. And I had realized, although perhaps on this or that or the other political problem, we may have differed from time to time, yet his purpose and my purpose and the ultimate objective of, I think, everybody in this room interested in the future of America, those purposes were identical. And the nation has lost one of its great leaders in his passing. I am glad to come here in the thought that Senator Borah of Idaho would want us to go on with the work of building a better citizenship in the days to come in the United States. You know, I go back, not as far as he did, but I go back a great many years. I go back to my days in college when I worked for an organization called the Social Service Committee. And after that, my wife came into the picture. And when we were engaged, I discovered that she was teaching classes of children on the East Side in New York. And then, very soon after I was admitted to the bar, I got to know another very great American, an old friend of yours and mine, Homer Folks. And probably Homer doesn't remember it himself, but in New York in those days, we were just beginning to take up the problem of providing milk for babies, for mothers, in all parts of that big city. And I, wanting to do something, in addition to trying to learn a little law, went in with an organization which has long ceased to exist, because it was absorbed by much greater organizations, the New York Milk Committee. And I worked for 2 or 3 years trying to help in placing milk stations for babies on the East Side and the West Side and up in the Bronx in New York City. Homer Folks was one of the principal moving agencies in setting that up. And it's rather an interesting thing that the woman who was most greatly responsible for helping to provide milk for dependent poor children in the great city of New York, Mrs. Borden Harriman, I sent Mrs. Harriman as United States Minister to Norway 2 years ago. Last April, when this conference first met, in this room, I asked you to consider 2 things. First, how a democracy can best serve its children. And the corollary, how children can best be helped to grow into the kind of citizens who will know how to preserve and perfect a democracy. Since that time, since last April, a succession of world events has shown us that our democracy must be strengthened at every point of strain or weakness. All Americans want this country to be a place where children can live in safety and grow in understanding of the part that they're going to play in the future of our American nation. And on that question, people have come to me and they've said, what about defense? Well, I said, internal defense and external defense, are one the same thing. You can't have one unless you can have both. Adequate national defense in the broadest term calls for adequate, yes, on the one side, munitions and implements of war. And at the same time, it calls for educated, healthy, and happy citizens. And neither are requisite. Taken alone, taken all by itself, without the other, will give us definite national security. And so today, in January 1940, it is my pleasure to receive from you the General Conference Report with its program of action. You've adopted this report after days of careful deliberation, preceded by nearly a year of study and discussion. And by way of illustration, I'm having a problem with the Congress of the United States as to whether the problems of the United States are going to be decided after a couple of days of careful deliberation in each house, or whether I'm going to get a couple of $1 million that would correspond to this year of study, this year of discussion that you good people have been putting in to the problem of children in a democracy. And I think I'm going to win out. When I started to jot down some notes about what I was going to say tonight, and so far I have been speaking, as you observe, practically extemporaneously, I said to myself, this is going to be the most dreadful speech I ever delivered. Why? Because when I come to write down notes, dictate a speech, I say to myself, what is it in this particular subject that I'm going to talk about that hit me between the eyes? And on this particular subject of children in a democracy, the thing that hit me between the eyes is what I got about a week ago, a list, a tabulation, a catalog. That's what you've been studying. And so I felt that the nation as a whole ought to realize that the subject of children covers several pages of a catalog. There are so many interests involved, so many problems involved. Almost everybody that's hearing me tonight, and I suppose in every state of the Union, thinks of children in terms of two or three of these subjects on the average. Two or three subjects in which he or she has some special experience or special interest. An interest such as the education of children, or the recreation of children, or the health of children. Or he may have some great enthusiasm for one particular kind of child welfare service. For instance, I myself am tremendously interested in crippled children. But this conference report rightly calls us to think of children as a whole, as each child is related not to one life, not to his own life, not only his own life, but the life of his brothers and sisters, the life of his family, and then, inevitably, the life of his community, the life of his county, the life of his state, and the life of his nation. And that's why, if people in this country are going to think of this problem as it really is, they've got to listen to a catalog for the next 10 minutes. I can illustrate best the extent to which the interests of children are interwoven with the interests of families and communities by giving you these main topics of the conference. And I don't think that there's any one of these topics that we can say, oh, well, that's awfully nice. But what relation has it to the problem of my child? Well, of course it has. Every subject here, in the first part of the conference report, reminds us sharply that by every step we take to protect the families of America, we're protecting the children also. Well, put that in another way. It means that what federal government, state government, county government, town government, village government, everything else, what they're doing to coordinate the economy and the social problems of their own communities in relation to the whole population necessarily has an effect on every child in that community. Here we find in this report the recommendations in general are constituting an argument for buttressing and strengthening, in the first instance, the institution of the family. The family as it relates, again, to a whole lot of things. Health, training, and opportunities of children in what we're pleased to call a democracy. And thank God it still is. This part of the discussion includes families and their income, families in need of assistance, families and their dwelling, and the family as a threshold to the future democracy of this country. Following that group of topics, the report discusses a lot of other things that either enter or ought to enter into the life of every American child in every part of the country. Schools, religion, leisure time activities. Mind you, these are all separate topics that we're trying to coordinate into one national picture. Libraries, protection against child labor, youth and the needs of youth, the conserving of child health, the social services for children, children in minority groups, and something that a lot of people forget, as I have good reason to know as the chief executive, the subject of public financing and administration. But what I'm specially pleased about is this, that this conference, made up men and women that belong to every political party, every part of the country, has found that we have definitely improved our social institutions and our public services during these past 10 years. And the only thing that good old Homer folks said that I don't agree with, he called them these terrible 10 years, and I don't. I think they've been the most interesting 10 years since what? Well, at least since the Civil War, and maybe since the Revolution. And we're all glad we've had a part in them. Because I believe that though we've had lots of troubles, lots of difficulties, that these past 10 years have been 10 useful years, and on the whole, 10 years of definite progress in a democracy. The conference concludes, and rightly, that to have made progress in a period of hardship and strain proves that America has both strength and courage. But, again, I agree with the conference, we've still got a long ways to go. Too many children, and you can find them in every state in the Union, are still living under conditions that must be corrected if our democracy is to develop to its highest capacity. The conference tells me that more than half of the children of America are living in families that do not have enough money to provide fully adequate shelter, adequate food, adequate clothing, adequate medical care, and adequate educational opportunity. I've been called to task, as you all know, because I've reiterated many times something about the one-third of America that's ill-clothed, ill-housed, ill-fed. Criticized on the ground that I was saying something derogatory. I've been telling the truth, and you good people have sustained me by that statement, that more than half the children of America are living in families that don't have enough money to provide fully adequate shelter, food, clothing, medical care, and educational opportunity. Why shouldn't we admit it? By admitting it, we're saying we're going to improve things. And that's more than the critics. Yes, and you are rightly concerned that provision be made for those who are unemployed, whether for economic or personal reasons, to keep families from starving while the fathers walk the streets in vain search of jobs will not give children the best start in life. Social insurance to provide against total loss of income and appropriate work objects adjusted to fluctuations in private employment and to both urban and rural needs constitute the first lines of defense against family disaster. And I'm glad for what's been said tonight about the rural problem. I think my very good friend, old friend, the mayor of New York, wouldn't mind my telling a story of what happened up at Hyde Park last autumn. He was up there lunching with us. Quite a big lunch, 18 or 20 people. And we were talking about the problem of the distribution of population in the United States. Well, that's an old thing that I've been sort of hobby about for a great many years, 20, 30 years. And I talked about the problem of overcrowding in cities. I talked about whether it's a good thing with a big question mark. About cities getting too big, the bigger cities getting still bigger, and whether we couldn't work on some plan for a greater decentralization of the population, the building up of the smaller community. And then, as a sort of a test, I said, you know, Fiorello, I'm going to say something awful that you won't agree with. I think your problem in New York City with 7 million men, women, and children is a bad one. I think that the problem of civilized life in a community of that size is almost too big a problem. And I think that New York would be better off if it had 6 million people instead of 7. And the mayor of New York looked at me and he said, Mr. President, I can't agree. He said, Mr. President, you're wrong. He said New York would be better off if it had 5 million people in it. That's it. And by way of following up the same subject, this is just purely from memory, but way back before the World War, somewhere around 1913 or 14, I was over here in the Navy Department, I read an extraordinarily interesting pamphlet. It carried out the thought that you've heard tonight about rural populations. It is by a great French doctor, who had made all kinds of examinations of records, vital statistics, in half a dozen of the great cities of Europe. And he had come to the conclusion, and had attempted to prove it, by family statistics, that any family that had been city bred for three or four generations died out, and that the only families in cities that survived were the families that had an influx of country blood every generation or two. Now, I don't know whether our modern medical friends will support that data, but at least it's something well worth our thinking about in terms of the America of the future. You tell me, in effect, in this report, that I've been talking about for many years, that we're moving forward toward an objective of raising the income and the living conditions of the poorest portion of our population, that we've made some dent on the problem, and that most decidedly we can't stop and rest on our rather meager laurels. Yes, I agree with you that public assistance of many kinds is necessary. But I suggest to you that the Federal Treasury has some bottom to it. And that mere grants in aid constitute no permanent solution of the problem of our health, our education, or our children. But that we should address ourselves to two definite policies. First, to increase the average of income in the poorer communities and in the poorer groups, in the poorer areas of the nation. And secondly, that we should address ourselves to an insistence that in every community, in every state, and the District of Columbia, they should pay taxes in accordance with ability to pay. The conference report, going on with this, what shall I call it, a Sears Roebuck catalog, but it's very educational to read a catalog. It's called attention also to the need for continuing and expanding public and private housing programs. If the families in the lowest groups, lowest income groups, are to live in dwellings suitable for the raising of children. Last April, take another item, I referred to our concern for the children of the migratory family who have no settled place of abode. I spoke casually to the press today about a study that I'm making. Up in the state of Washington, we're spending a great many millions to harness the Columbia River. Put a great dam up there that will pump the water up onto a huge area of land capable of providing a living for 500,000 people. Irrigated land, today a desert, which can be made a garden with the processes of modern science. Who ought to go there? Are we going to treat that 2 years from now, just as we treat the average irrigation project? First come, first serve, a contract with the government to pay out the loan over a period of years, first come, first served. I've read a book called The Grapes of Wrath. There are 500,000 Americans that live in the covers of that book. I'd like to see the Columbia Basin devoted to the care of 500,000 members of the Grapes of Wrath. migratory families, the situation of their children, children who have no home, can put down no roots, can't live in a community, that calls for special consideration. But I'm being practical. I'm trying to find a place for them to go. Yes, it means in its simplest terms a program for the permanent resettlement of at least 1 million people. Columbia Basin and a lot of other places. And remember that the money spent on it, after careful planning, is going to be returned to the United States government many times over in a relatively short time. To go on, your report has devoted many pages to family economics. I know very little about that. My wife does. We all recognize that the spirit within the home is the most important influence in the growth of the child. In family life, the child should first learn confidence in his own power, respect for the feelings and the rights of others, security of mutual goodwill, and faith in God. Here he should find a common bond between the interests of the individual and the interests of the group. Mothers and fathers for the kind of life they build within the four walls of the home are largely responsible for the future public and social life of the country. And just as we cannot take care of the child apart from the family, so the child's welfare is bound up with a lot of other institutions that influence his development. The school, the church, the agencies that offer useful and happy activities and interests for leisure time. The work of all these institutions needs to be harmonized even more than it is today, so as to give to our children rounded growth with the least possible conflict and loss of effort. And the money and the hard work that go into these public and private enterprises are again repaid many times. And I think that religion especially, helps children to appreciate life in its wholeness, to develop a deep sense of the sacredness of human personality, in view of the estimate that perhaps one half of the children of America are having no regular religious instruction. It seems to me important to consider how provision can best be made for some kind of religious training. We can do it because in this we are capable of keeping in mind both the wisdom of maintaining the separation of church and state and at the same time giving weight to the great importance of religion in personal and social living. And I share with you the belief that fair opportunity for schooling ought to be available to every child in this country. I agree with you that no American child, merely because he happens to be born where property values are low and local taxes don't, even though they should, support the schools, that child should be placed at a disadvantage in his preparation for citizenship. Certainly our future is endangered when nearly 1 million children of elementary school age are not in school, when thousands of school districts and even some entire states do not pay for good schools. This situation has been reported by many agencies, private and public, and the way I've got it down here in my manuscript, it says, and needs to be still more widely understood. That doesn't mean anything. What I really wanted to say is this. I'd like to put on the front page of every newspaper in the United States the most backward school districts, the most backward school states in the United States. That rough treatment. But if every person in the United States could know where the conditions are worse, education and health, those areas would get the sympathy, the understanding, and the help for improving those worst of conditions. And again, I have to suggest that the permanent answer is not mere handouts from the Federal Treasury, but has to be solved by improving the economics of those poorer sections. And an insistence, hand in hand with it, on adequate taxation in accordance with ability to pay. We must plan also on a larger scale to give American children a chance for healthful play, worthwhile use of leisure. I agree with you that a democratic government has a vital interest in those matters. And I am glad that you have suggested a national commission under private auspices to study leisure time needs and recreational resources. More than in any previous decade, we know how to safeguard the health of parents and children. Because of the advance of medical knowledge and the growth of public health work, we have it in our power to conquer diseases that we couldn't conquer 10 years ago, and the ability to promote general good health. New opportunities to us mean new duties. It was one thing to let people sicken and die when we were helpless to protect them. And it's now quite another thing to leave a large portion of our population without care at all. It's my definite hope that within the next 10 years, every part of the country, just to use an example, and I believe that hope can be fulfilled, that every part of the United States will have complete and adequate service for all women during maternity and for all newborn infants. That we can do. So, too, good nutrition is the basis of child health. And I am equally in sympathy with your suggestion that I appoint a national nutrition committee to review our present knowledge, to coordinate our efforts, looking toward the development of nutrition policies based on the newest and the best methods. And we're making new discoveries every day. The members of the conference have charted a course for 10 years to come. Nevertheless, the steps that we take now, this year of 1940, are going to determine how far we can go tomorrow and in what direction. I believe with you that if anywhere in the country any child lacks opportunity for home life, for health protection, for education, for moral or spiritual development, the strength of the nation and its ability to cherish and advance the principles of democracy are thereby weakened. I ask that all our fellow citizens who are within the sound of my voice to consider themselves identified with the work of this conference. I ask you all to study and discuss with friends and neighbors the program that it has outlined, to study how its objectives can be realized. May the security and the happiness of every boy and girl in our land be our concern, our personal concern from now on. You, the members of this conference of children in a democracy, you are the leaders of a new American army of peace.
In the famous famous East Room of the White House in Washington, the President of the United States has addressed the second meeting of the 4th Annual White House Conference on Children in a Democracy. This present conference met yesterday and will adjourn tomorrow. Homer Folks of New York, who attended the first conference in 1909, tonight presented to the President a report outlining the needs of children and suggestions for meeting them. The session tomorrow will be devoted to plans for putting the report into operation. This broadcast has reached you from the White House. This is the National Broadcasting Company.